Please sit down, and we're going to have our reading now, which you can find in the Bibles on page 1005. It's Hebrews chapter 8, or it's on the inside of your sheet if you've got one of those near you as well. Helen's going to lead our reading, but before that, let me lead us in a prayer. Our Father, we're so grateful that you are a speaking God. Thank you that you reveal yourself to us and you reveal to us your plans for humanity and how we can get in step and benefit from all that you're doing. Please help us to tune in now as we hear your word read and then preached to us, and help us to respond appropriately. We pray in your name. Amen.
We're in Hebrews 8, which is on the Church Bible, page 1005. And I'll just explain. I'll be reading the first part, verses 1 through to 7. And then you're invited from verse 8 onwards, which we don't need quite yet. Thank you, guys. You just want to go one back. Thank you. I'll invite you for a responsive reading. So I'll continue to read the normal font, and you're invited to read the bits. The verse in bold. Hebrews 8, starting at verse 1. Now the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. Now continuing on that, on the screen. For he finds fault with them when he says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers, on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, for they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people, and they shall not teach each one his neighbor, and each one his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful towards their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more." In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away.
Morning to you all. My name is Jono, if we haven't met before, and very warm welcome if you're here just for the first time today celebrating Koki's baptism. We're glad that you've joined us, and we're going to look at this passage together in some detail. But before we get into those verses, I wanted to begin with a story that some of you may remember from your history lessons when you were younger, or you may have seen the depiction of on the recent TV show about the royalty, The Crown. And it's the story of the abdication of King Edward VIII. Let me just fill you in with the story if you don't know what happened. So let me take you back to January of 1936. Edward VIII has just become the king of the United Kingdom. And at this time, he has a relationship going on. And it's a relationship with an American lady called Wallis Simpson. And this lady was disapproved of by the establishment of the day. She had been divorced once and at this time was in the process of being divorced for a second time. And that wasn't thought well of by the establishment. So that's January. And now we're going to fast forward 10 months to November of the same year, November 1936. And the king, King Edward, he organizes a meeting with the prime minister. And at this meeting, he tells him that he wants to marry this woman. He wants to marry Wallis Simpson. And to cut a long story short, basically, he's told that he can't do that. And if he wants to remain king, then he can't marry this woman. And so he's left with this choice. Does he want to marry the woman or does he want to keep the crown? He can't have both. It's one or the other. And of course, famously, he chose the woman instead of the crown. And so he had to renounce his throne. And as of December 1936, he was no longer the king of the United Kingdom. I guess there will be a variety of opinions at the time on whether this was a right decision or a wrong decision. But I guess there would at least be some people who thought that this was the wrong decision that he made. And one reason you might give for that is because of the great privilege it is to be the king of the United Kingdom. It's a very prestigious position, isn't it? I mean, think of all that Edward was giving up by renouncing his throne. Think of all the authority he had ruling over millions of people. Think of all of the wealth that he had that others couldn't dream of having. Think of the honor he had being treated like nobody else. People might say he had something so good. How could he throw it away? Well, we've been thinking in this series in the book of Hebrews, not about renouncing the throne, but about the danger of renouncing a Christian faith, a trust in the Lord Jesus, and the pressure, the inclination that people can easily feel if they're Christians, to walk away from Jesus and to give up on their faith. And we've thought about a variety of different reasons, different causes for that. But one of the things that we've identified is the reality of hardships in the Christian life. Maybe it's hardships in the workplace might be one example that Christians experience. Maybe you're somebody here, if you're a Christian, who's experienced difficulties in your workplace because of your Christian faith. I mentioned early on in the series a local GP in the area where I grew up, and he was a Christian. And when there was what he thought of as appropriate opportunities to share something of his Christian faith, help his patients, he would do so. And on one of these occasions, he shared something, and there was a complaint, or shared something of his Christian faith. And there was a complaint by the mother of this patient. And that complaint was escalated into a court hearing where his livelihood was in jeopardy. And all the while, he was facing this battle with bowel cancer. So it's a really tricky situation for him. And I can imagine if I was in that kind of situation thinking, if this is what the Christian life is going to be like, you know, maybe I should just throw in the towel. If it's going to be this difficult. Hardships in the workplace, maybe you've experienced things like that, or maybe hardships in relationships because of your Christian faith. I mentioned last week a friend of mine who, before they became a Christian, had a very close friendship with a flatmate. But then after becoming a Christian, that relationship became very tense and very difficult because this flatmate didn't like the changes that were going on in this person's life and the beliefs that this person now held to. And so this flatmate made it very clear that he didn't want to be friends with this person anymore. It's a very hard situation, isn't it? And I guess there'd be others of us who had similar situations with family, with friends, because of your Christian faith. And maybe makes us feel, if this is what the Christian life is like, maybe I should throw in the towel. Maybe if it's going to be this hard, I should just give up. Well, throughout the book of Hebrews, the author's assessment of that has been that that would be a tragic decision. To throw away what we have would be a tragic decision. And we're going to see that the reason today, particularly, is because of, like the king, of the great privilege of being a Christian. I think the author wants us saying, I have something so precious, how could I throw it away? And particularly under our second point today, we're going to think about the nature of this privilege and unpack this better covenant that Jesus launches. But before we get there, we're going to, under our first point, think about the basis of this privilege and see the groundwork that Jesus, our high priest, we've been thinking about Jesus as our high priest throughout this service, and the groundwork he lays as our high priest to bring about this result and this outcome of this better covenant. So that's where we're heading. And you can see on the inside of your service sheets, there's some headings that hopefully will help you as we go through this passage together. So first point, Jesus does a better priestly work. And this is verses 1-6 of our passage. We thought a bit about this last week, in a sense, when we were thinking about the duration of Jesus' priestly work. So we thought about the fact that he's a permanent priest. He's a priest forever. But this week and next week, we're going to think more about the details of Jesus' priestly work. And particularly, we're going to think about two elements to Jesus' priestly work,
which are better than that of Old Testament Israel and the priesthood that they had. So two elements. We're going to think about what Jesus offers and also where he offers. So the place and location that he brings his offering to. So we'll start briefly, more briefly at least, with what Jesus offers. And really in this passage, we just get a trailer of this. So just have a look at verse 3. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest, that's Jesus, also to have something to offer. So by very nature of being a high priest means that you're a person who brings offerings and brings sacrifices. And because Jesus is a high priest, he will need to bring the offering as well. And we're going to think more about that next week, and we'll see a more full presentation of it in chapter 9. But we're going to focus on, in this passage, where Jesus offers, the place and location that he brings his offering, his sacrifice into. And we're going to do a bit of comparison with Israel's priests. So let's start with Israel's priests and see the place that they bring their offerings to. Have a look at verse 5 in our passage. They, that's the priests in the Old Testament, they serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. So the basic point that's being made is about the tabernacle. That's the tent that was set up in the wilderness by the people of Israel, where God came to dwell. And that was the place that was a replica. It was a copy of something greater, a copy and shadow of the heavenly things, the verse says. And then the author goes on to prove the point. So the rest of verse 5. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, that's the tabernacle, he was instructed by God saying, see that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. So the author says to us, even going back as far as the book of Exodus, we can see that this tabernacle was only ever meant to be a copy and a replica of something beyond. It was only ever based on this pattern that Moses was shown as he was given all of the instructions and details of what this tabernacle was to look like. So that's the place that they serve in, the copy, the replica. But that isn't the place that Jesus serves in. So let's have a look at the first two verses of this chapter. I'll read for us. Now, the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. So part of what these verses tell us is Jesus' current position, where he is now. And it says, doesn't it, that he is in heaven. So having died, having risen from the dead, having ascended to God's right hand, he sat down there in heaven. That's where he is now. That's his current position. But then as we go into the second verse, heaven gets identified as the true tent or the true tabernacle, which shows us that that place, the tabernacle in the wilderness, that was a replica. What it was a replica of is the place that Jesus has now actually entered, the real dwelling place of God, heaven itself. Now, at this point, I want to tell you a little bit about my gran. And she, when she was alive, had a big collection in a glass cabinet in her house of these model miniature houses that were based on houses across the UK. And one of them she had was a house called Thaxted Guildhall. I've got a picture of it on the screen. I'll just go to you. This is a little model house that we have in our house that Gran gave to me. Well, I received when she died. And the author's point is that the tabernacle is like this. It's a model based on the real building itself, the real place itself. But on the other hand, the place that Jesus entered is like Thaxted Guildhall itself. It's the real house, the real building. That's where Jesus has entered, the real dwelling place of God, not the copy tabernacle, but the real heavenly tabernacle. So Jesus does a better priestly work because he entered the true tabernacle, heaven itself. So that's the groundwork that Jesus, our high priest, lays. And next we're going to see, and we're going to spend most of the time here, the result and outcome of Jesus' better priestly work. So we've seen that Jesus does a better priestly work, and point two, which launches a better covenant. And this is the rest of our passage. And again, the point of comparison here is Jesus with Old Testament Israel. But this time the comparison isn't with their priests, but with their covenant, the structure, the situation within which they related to God. And the author wants us to see that the Christian has a better covenant. And we're going to think about what is better about this covenant. And we actually get quite a nice answer to that question in verse 6, which is also a kind of hinge verse in the passage that kind of links together our two points. Let me read verse 6. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better. And here's the reason: since it is enacted on better promises. And we're going to see what these better promises are as we go into this long quote that we read together from Jeremiah 31, this prophet in the Old Testament who speaks of this new covenant that God is going to make with his people. And this is really where we're going to think about the great privilege it is to be a Christian. So three promises, I think, in this prophecy from Jeremiah. Firstly, the promise of obedience to God. Now, under the old covenant, the majority report is that they weren't able to obey God. And actually, that's been illustrated for us already in the book of Hebrews. Back in chapters 3 and 4, you might remember the way that we looked at that generation who came out of Egypt, who went through the wilderness. But when it came to entering the land, they didn't trust God's promise to give it to them. And they didn't obey God's command to take the land. And there were a few exceptions. So Joshua and Caleb, we looked at this in our Bible overview in small groups this year as well. They did trust God, but they were the kind of exceptions. They were the outliers. For the most part, the majority report is that they weren't able to obey God. But the wonderful thing about this new covenant is things have changed. Now we are able to obey God. Let me just read from the beginning of that quotation in verse 8. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. And here's the key bit. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts. So where under the old covenant, the law, the commands of, they were written externally, weren't they? They were written on the tablets of stone that Moses was given with the Ten Commandments. But under this new covenant, wonderfully, things are different. God has inscribed, written his law internally on our hearts and minds. And that means the result is that we now can obey God. I think sometimes as Christians, we imagine that progress and change isn't really possible in the Christian life. You know, the Christian life is purely characterized by falling short, moral failure, not meeting God's commands. But actually, this promise tells us, doesn't it, that progress and change is possible for the Christian. That doesn't mean that they'll reach moral perfection or anything like that, but there can be real change, real transformation. I found this a real encouragement this week, thinking about this and realizing that we don't actually need to have a kind of defeatist mentality when it comes to sin in our lives. We don't have to think, you know, I'll never change in this area. Or, you know, this habit is too hardwired. I'll never make any progress there. Actually, this verse tells us the opposite, doesn't it? We can be much more optimistic. Under this new covenant, God can and does change us. That's a wonderful thing. Well, that's the first promise of this new covenant. The second promise, the promise of relationship with God. Now, again, under the old covenant, some people had a personal relationship with God. So just think of Moses. He's probably the prime example of this. He could approach God, couldn't he? The way that he ascended Mount Sinai and met with God there, the way that he entered the tent of meeting and met with God in the tent. He could approach God, and also he could speak with God, couldn't he? So he was the one who received the laws from the Lord and delivered them to the people. God spoke to him, and also he spoke to God. There were various occasions in the first part of the Bible where Moses prays for the people on their behalf and intercedes for them. So that is the situation under the old covenant. Some had a personal relationship with God, but most had a much more impersonal relationship with God. Just think of the rest of the people in Moses' day. They didn't approach God, didn't they? Did they? They didn't ascend Mount Sinai and meet him there. They didn't enter into the tent of meeting like he did. And they didn't speak with God, actually, really. Moses alone was the one who received the laws. And Moses alone was the one who prayed for the people. But then wonderfully, that is a great point of contrast with this new covenant. Under this new covenant, all Christians have a personal relationship with God. Let me just read on in verse 10 where we left off. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. So under this new covenant, our relationship with God doesn't have this kind of indirect, impersonal form to it. Like in verse 11, the way that knowledge of God comes through the neighbor saying, know the Lord, or the brother saying, know the Lord. It won't have that kind of indirect nature to it. Instead, we all can approach God. They shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. Or to use the language of earlier in Hebrews, we can draw near to the throne of grace. Sometimes on podcasts I watch, they have these kind of quick-fire Q&A things that they have with their guests. And one of the most popular questions I find that comes up a lot is, who's the most famous contact in your phone? You know, they'll always say someone really impressive that the host is amazed by, like LeBron James or Barack Obama or Taylor Swift or someone else like that. And I guess we feel that it's a great privilege, because to have them as your phone contact is to know them personally, isn't it? It's to have this kind of direct access to them. But actually, the Christian has an even greater privilege than that, don't they? The Christian knows the God of the universe, the creator of all things, personally, directly. It's a wonderful privilege. So we've thought about these two promises, the promise of obedience to God, the promise of relationship with God. And both of these are built on one more foundational promise that we get in this quotation. And we can see that from the four at the beginning of verse 12. It's because that grounds all that's come before in this quotation. And it's the promise of forgiveness from God. Now, under the old covenant, there was sort of, in one sense, a kind of forgiveness, but it was provisional, a provisional forgiveness. And that's why I think the offerings that you read about in Hebrews and you read about in the Old Testament, they had to be repeated, didn't they? So some of these offerings for sin were repeated on a daily basis, some on a yearly basis, like the ones on the Day of Atonement. But again, things are different under this new covenant. It isn't just a provisional forgiveness. It is a definitive and decisive forgiveness. And as I said earlier, we're going to think next week about the mechanism of this in what Jesus offers in chapter 9. But here we just get the conclusion stated. Verse 12, for I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. I guess many of us here will have had the situation in our lives where we've wronged someone badly, and as a result, the relationship with that person is damaged. And perhaps you don't speak to that person for a while. Maybe after a while, though, the relationship is repaired and you make up and they say that they've forgiven you. If you're anything like me, you probably have that kind of nagging feeling, though, at the back of your mind. Have they really forgiven me? You know, if this came back up in an argument, would they bring it back up again? Do they still feel a bitterness about what I did? It's quite an unsettling feeling, isn't it? But the wonderful news of this new covenant is that we needn't have that feeling with God. He has decisively forgiven us. He says, I will remember their sins no more. It's a wonderful privilege to be a Christian. Jesus launches a better covenant, one where we can obey God, one where we have relationship with God, one where we have forgiveness from God. Well, we've begun today, didn't we, by thinking about the hardships that the Christian life can be characterized by. Maybe that's something you're experiencing at the moment if you're a Christian here today. If not, it will be something that comes in the future. And it's easy in those moments to think, if this is what the Christian life is like, maybe I should throw the towel in. Maybe I should walk away from Jesus. Maybe it isn't worth it. But again and again, our author wants us to see that that would be a tragic decision. And today's reason is because of the amazing privilege it is to be a Christian. And we've thought about the basis of this privilege in the better high priestly work that Jesus does. And also in the nature of this privilege, in this better covenant that Jesus has launched, and all that that entails, all that that means for us. We can obey God. We have law written internally on our hearts and on our minds. We have relationship with God, knowing him personally. and we have definitive forgiveness from him. I will remember their sins no more, he says. And I think we're meant to finish this passage feeling, I have something so precious. How could I ever throw it away? Well, we'll take a moment of pause now just to dwell on what we've been seeing in this chapter and what the Lord's been saying to us. Then we'll be led in prayer.